Welcome to the Formwork podcast, where we talk about the ideas that shape our world. I'm Ben Lima. Our guest today is Tasma, who's professor of philosophy and distinguished scholar at Columbia College Chicago, and the author of many important books, including On Monsters, An Unnatural History of Our Worst Fears, Stuffed Animals and Pickled Heads, The Culture and Evolution of Natural History Museums, Buddha for Beginners, and The Gods Drink Whiskey, Stumbling Toward Enlightenment in the Land of the Tattered Buddha. His book, The Evolution of Imagination, came out last year from the University of Chicago Press, and his new book, coming out in May from Oxford, is entitled Why We Need Religion. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
I wanted to start with one of the more eye-catching lines on your resume, which is that you're an accomplished musician, and you've played with Bo Diddley and Buddy Guy. So I wanted to ask you about musical improvisation, which is an important subject in your book, and something that I've wondered about ever since taking guitar lessons as a kid. If you're learning how to play an instrument, you can practice scales, and you can practice chords, and you can learn how to play songs. But when it comes time to actually improvise, from a scientific perspective, how do you understand what's happening in the brain when someone like Buddy Guy is improvising a solo?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's a sense in which the new brain science, these fMRI machines, are giving us better access to what's happening in the brain. But we're just starting to do this research, and it's hard to see what a brain is doing during a musical performance because the technology requires you to lay in this, you know, giant magnet, essentially. There has been some work by a neuroscientist named Charles Lim, who's put people into an fMRI machine while they played a kind of specially designed keyboard. And what they find is that when you're playing classical pieces, there's a very strong activity of the prefrontal cortex. And when you switch to playing improvisational music like jazz, this part of the brain, which is very much sort of a picture, it's sort of like at the front of your sort of your forehead, but maybe around to the side slightly where your temples are. This part of the brain goes very quiet. And then the medial frontal cortex actually lights up. And so the argument is that what's happening in improvisation is you're relaxing this more executive function of the brain and letting the more free associational parts of the brain do their work. But of course, none of this will work unless you've trained to improvise. And when you, like you said, when you learn the scales and the chords, that's a very deliberate process. It's not like magical or associational. It's very sequential, like this note followed by this note. And then what you do is you learn these phrases that if you only played them, they would feel like stale cliches. But they are sort of chunks or phrases that you can pull out when you run into trouble. So if somebody says, play an improvisation in A minor, and they give you some chords to go over, you know roughly what the scale is, and you're trying something new, but you're also falling back on these cliches that you know work. And if you see somebody like Buddy Guy improvise, and he's a great improviser, you'll see him stretch out into areas, because I was on the road with him for like 2 weeks straight. So I would play, and then I would watch him play his set afterwards. And it was fun because you would see if he was feeling good, he would stretch into these areas that he had never been in before. And then if he was getting lost, he would go to these more cliche guitar moves. And, you know, things that he knows the audience is going to like, because he's also an entertainer. So then the audience would light up, and then he would maybe stretch out and try other things again, and then fall back on these cliches. So I think real improvisation is a combination of trying note sequences that you haven't tried before together with these tried and these trusty cliches.
Another sort of angle on the same issue, again, from your own experience as a practitioner, as a musician, when you're sort of exploring scientific theories about creativity and so forth, as you're thinking about these, do you sort of test them against your own experience making music and see if that has any connection, or is it sort of a separate thing?
Yeah, that's interesting. There are some overlaps. One of the things that by studying improvisers a lot and this theory of the brain, how these sort of this concert of these brain areas, what I came to realize was that if you were too prepared, you actually will have a kind of stilted performance. And the playing is sort of flat, and it's hard to describe exactly, but you know when something sounds kind of dead. Even John Dewey talked about this with regard to artwork generally. Sometimes the artwork feels dead, and sometimes it feels really animated and alive. And I noticed that when I figured this out by looking at other improvisers, I started to do it in my own performances. So I just played a gig last week with a woman, a phenomenal singer named Michelle Thomas, and she sings blues and jazz standards, and I had not really played a gig with her ever, so we decided that we would play this gig without really rehearsing. We met a couple of days ahead of time, and we just played the beginnings of some of these tunes to see if we could at all fit together. And then the night of the performance, we get up and there's a room full of people and you have to play. And so what we've done is we've put ourselves into a very high stakes situation.
Yeah.
These people have paid and they want to hear good music. And she and I are completely exposed and vulnerable. And so every mistake can be heard and seen. But it also, that kind of pressure makes you solve musical problems in ways that you would never do if you were rehearsing everything. So that kind of jeopardy is really good for an improviser, even though it's kind of uncomfortable. You end up doing things you would never have done.
Wow, amazing. You pointed out that in the history of philosophy, both Aristotle and Kant recognized the importance of the imagination, but then there was a long period of sort of downplaying its importance. Could you talk about why historically the imagination has been underrated by many philosophers and why that might be changing?
Yeah, I think what happened in psychology, at least, is there was the promise that we were going to look at imagination with people like William James. This is true in philosophy too, because William James had a foot in both camps, philosophy and psychology. But then psychology definitely went in the direction of behaviorism. And behaviorism, you know, with the influence of people like Skinner and the Pavlovian conditioning and so forth, we decided we would study behaviors that we could see and observe. And the nature of the imagination is that most of that work is hidden within the subject. You know, it's going on in the mind.
Right.
And psychology went with the stuff that could be objectively observed and you could build up theories about behavior. And then when it looked like it was going to be promising, like we might come back to the mind, the computer metaphor took root in the 60s, 70s, and 80s and gave us the cognitive science version of psychology. And again, there's not a lot of interest or way to access the imagination if what you're thinking about is computational algorithms. And I don't blame psychology because this produced a lot of successful work. We ended up creating neural networks and all this stuff, and it was great for computational work. But I think at this point, we've got to very successful understandings of AI, but we're missing this whole dimension of the mind, which is creativity. Other dimensions too, like we don't have any way to model emotions very well with both behaviorism and with cognitive science. So I feel like there's an affective or emotional turn in psychology. And at the same time, there's a turn back towards trying to understand creativity and imagination, which is my work is trying to help with that turn slowly.
Yeah. You talked about the way that human imagination allows us to decouple a mental image from our immediate perceptions so that, for example, we can imagine a snake. We have an image of the snake in our minds, even when there's no snake in front of us. And you suggest that this kind of simulation gives us a knowledge that might be underrated by scientists sometimes, that it is not just for fun or it's not just cheesecake or amusement. For example, if you want to understand people better, read Dostoevsky. That kind of simulation allows us to have real important knowledge. Could you talk a little bit about why this kind of imaginative knowledge is so important for people to have?
Yeah, I think in philosophy and in science, the assumption has been that knowledge is going to be something that you can do experiments and make empirical observations and model. There's no doubt that's true. That's how we understand nature, and it's the best method we have. But I do think this area of understanding human behavior and actions through art and literature has been undervalued. And I think that it's the best way to understand human beings is through films and novels, because you can represent the emotions that the character is going through. One of the great things about Dostoevsky is when I was reading him, I thought he's really good at describing how a person can have an emotion that's very positive, like, here's a guy who really likes this woman, let's say. He's attracted to her. Actually mixed with this feeling is some terrible dread or negative emotion too.
Yeah.
And Dostoevsky's really great at showing these gradations and shades between two conflicting emotions.
Yeah.
And if you just look at scientific theory, you're not going to find that kind of stuff. Or historically, you didn't find that kind of nuance.
Listening to you talk about this, it really strikes me how in the news lately, there's been so much about artificial intelligence and AI and the rapid progress of this, but it also does seem like there's not much discussion at all about whether these better and better AIs are going to have anything resembling emotion or be able to, you know, write a novel or perform a creative work or anything like that. It makes me wonder, like, is that ever going to happen, or is it just, you know, more advanced or more complicated? I mean, do you have any opinions on that?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. We have increasingly created sort of machine learning that can solve all kinds of informational puzzles and problems. And you have like Deep Blue winning chess games and Watson, you know, winning Jeopardy types of games. But the question that you're raising is, would AI ever attain the level of feeling or even conscious awareness or anything like this? And this, I think, is a problem for cognitive science as it's been done so far. My own view is very influenced by affective neuroscience, which is emotional neuroscience. And there's a couple of interesting characters. One is Antonio Damasio and the late great Jacques Panksepp. And they noticed that what happens in the brain is we have informational processing, but also the organs like the amygdala work together with perception and memory to code concepts with feelings. So Damasio, for example, had a patient who had damage to his amygdala. And this guy would go, like you and I, in terms of his cognitive abilities, he was very smart. He could solve logic puzzles. But if he went to the store and was standing in front of the cereal aisle, he was overwhelmed by the logical possibilities of like what cereal he should buy. You know, he's just like stunned because there's like 50 different things. The problem was that his amygdala was not functioning. And the Damasio hypothesized that meant he had no feeling that tilted him one way or the other, given a choice. Like every choice seemed logically compelling to him. So at one point, Damasio was asking him, like, when do you want to come back for the next appointment? The guy was like, I don't know. He's like, Monday, yeah. Tuesday, Wednesday. So this is kind of exciting because it suggests that even basic information processing in my mind and your mind is coded with a feeling state, an emotion, like you feel good about it or you feel bad about it. Well, as far as we know, no computer has this kind of coding system, and we don't know how to give it to a computer. You can write codes that have preferential tendencies, but they're just more informational bits. Whereas the way in which you and I do this kind of information problem solving is our nervous system has conditioned us to make these associations.
We're talking with Stephen Asma about the evolution of imagination. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk more about why we need religion.